This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. White House Health Advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci said the pandemic is the worst seen in more than a century. Fauci spoke as President Donald Trump issued a stout defense Tuesday of a disproved use of an anti-malaria drug as a treatment for the coronavirus. Meanwhile, Fauci rejected President Trump's renewed claims after a controversial tweet suggested the doctor has misled the public about hydroxychloroquine. Trump retweeted a post that alleged Fauci has misled the American people on many issues, but in particular on dismissing hydroxychloroquine. Fauci responded by saying, I have not been misleading the American public under any circumstances. More than 4 million people here in the U.S. have been infected by the coronavirus, and the death toll is nearing 150,000. One of the most frustrating symptoms of COVID-19 is the loss of the sense of smell, and scientists now say they think they understand why it happens. The experts writing in the journal Science Advances said the coronavirus infiltrates the cells that provide major structural support to sensory neurons, the neurons that detect odors, and send those messages to the brain. Since the sense of smell is linked to the sense of taste, the coronavirus also affects the ability to taste food. Harvard Medical School researchers said 90% of recovering COVID-19 patients who lost their sense of smell and taste regained it. In separate studies, scientists are still trying to conclude whether it's possible to get COVID-19 twice. For more news, as always, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, or the VOA mobile app. Via remote, this is VOA News. U.S. Attorney General William Barr is defending sending hundreds of federal agents to Portland, Oregon, and elsewhere to stop violent protests, while opposition Democrats accused him of violating the civil rights of peaceful protesters. This was Barr's first appearance as Attorney General before the Democratic-controlled House Judiciary Committee, where the Democrats accused him of taking such actions in Portland to support President Trump's re-election bid in November. Barr said the protests in Portland have become disconnected from their initial purpose, which was to protest the death of an African-American man, George Floyd, while in police custody in the state of Minnesota back in late May. Brazilian healthcare workers are urging the International Criminal Court to investigate President Jair Bolsonaro's government for crimes against humanity for its handling of the corona pandemic. A complaint containing evidence statements from unions representing more than 1 million healthcare workers has been submitted to the Hague-based court. The unions accused Bolsonaro's administration of being criminally negligent in its management of the COVID-19 outbreak, jeopardizing the lives of healthcare professionals and the general public. Bolsonaro, who just tested negative for the coronavirus after being infected with the virus for nearly 3 weeks, has repeatedly said the restrictions hurt the country's economy. Brazil has the highest number of COVID-19 cases in Latin America, with more than 2.4 million and more than 87,000 deaths. Staying in Brazil, the economic devastation caused by the coronavirus has forced many businesses in the Brazilian city of Rio de Janeiro to close. Those living there are no longer able to participate in the traditional everyday pleasures they used to enjoy before the pandemic, including buying costumes for the carnival or even having a cup of coffee. The Brazilian Institute of Geography and Statistics reported that 70% of companies in Brazil said the pandemic had a negative impact in their business. Firms in the service industry were most affected, followed by factories, construction, and commerce. Hundreds of people protested in Tel Aviv Tuesday, pressing forward with more than a month-long campaign calling on longtime leader Benjamin Netanyahu to step down. Public discontent with the government's handling of the coronavirus outbreak and resulting economic crisis has drawn thousands, including many young Israelis, to twice-weekly protests demanding Netanyahu resign from office while on trial for corruption. For more news, please join us at our website. That is voanews.com or the VOA mobile app. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. Today is Wednesday, July 29th. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington, filling in for James Butte this week and next. We have a great show for you lined up, so do not reduce the volume. Here are the stories we are covering. COVID-19 is spreading in Malawi's prisons.
To be very honest, it is becoming a little bit tough to prevent and manage this pandemic in our prisons, simply because, you know, our prisons are over-congested, so some of the measures we are supposed to implement or enforce in the light of COVID-19 pandemic cannot work.
That was Chimwewe Shaba, national spokesperson for Malawi Prison Services. Also ahead, an update on the deadly attack in Sudan's Darfur region. The United States military admits to civilian casualties in Somalia. Uganda's opposition cries foul after the resignation of members of the country's electoral commission, why some Ugandan comedians are in jail, and journalists in Sierra Leone say press freedom is improving.
I think journalists now have the freedom and the liberty to do their work without fear or favor.
That was Ahmed Saeed Nasrallah, president of Sierra Leone's Journalist Association. All those stories are next on Daybreak Africa. Top story today is in Malawi, where pressure is mounting on authorities to consider decongesting the country's prisons after 51 inmates and 16 prison guards tested positive for COVID-19 in the past 2 weeks. Prisoners' rights activists are pushing for immediate release of the infected inmates as a measure to prevent the disease from spreading further among the prison population. Lamek Messina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi prison authorities say they have been deeply concerned since the first COVID-19 case was confirmed on July 14 at Nzimba Prison in northern Malawi. Chimwemwe Shawa is the national spokesperson for Malawi Prison Services. He spoke via a messaging app.
To be very honest, it is becoming a little bit tough to prevent and manage this pandemic in our prisons, simply because, you know, our prisons are over-congested, so some of the measures we are supposed to implement or enforce in the light of COVID-19 pandemic cannot work. For example, issues of social distance.
Shawa says prison authorities have introduced various measures to help contain the virus, such as putting all infected prisoners into separate areas and a ban on visits by prisoners' friends and family.
And again, we have suspended our day-to-day operations that require inmates to go out of prison formations to work so that we reduce the risk of contact between the inmates and the outsiders.
Shawa also says all new inmates are now being quarantined for 14 days before being sent to various prisons. However, prisoners' rights lobby groups say this is not enough. They have instead appealed to President Lazarus Chakwera to consider releasing some inmates to decongest the prisons. The Center for Human Rights Education, Advice and Assistance is among seven rights groups calling for decongestion of the prisons. Victor Muhango is its executive director.
Our prisons are very congested. The space which was meant for 5,500 prisoners, as I'm talking today, is being accommodated by 40,000 prisoners. If we can just let the prison to be the way they are today, it will be actually the breeding ground for the virus.
In the letter to the president, Muhango says they suggested a number of factors for the president to consider.
We are talking of terminally ill prisoners. We have so many prisoners on TB. We've been hearing from health experts as well that if this virus can contact someone with some other diseases, then I think the possibility of someone dying is very high. So we are also talking of old age. We have some people with 65, 70, 80 years old who are in prison.
The call comes a few days after President Chakwera pardoned the first prisoner to contract coronavirus. Home Affairs Minister Richard Chimwendo Banda told VOA by phone Monday the government has taken heed of the call to release some prisoners. Banda said the government committee will meet Tuesday for a final recommendation on how to decongest the prisons. He says they will also put in place measures to prevent further spread of COVID-19. Prison spokesperson Shawa said this arrangement has prompted prison guards to call off planned sit-in strike this week against lack of personal protective equipment in prisons. Lameck Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
More details are emerging about the deadly attack in Sudan's West Darfur region that left 60 people dead and dozens more wounded over the weekend. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, said Wednesday that 5 children were among the dead at Mestere Village and 9 other children were injured. UNICEF said all were between the ages of 1 and 3. The group cited reports that 1,500 houses were burned. For more on the aftermath of the attack, I spoke to journalist Michael Atit in Khartoum, Sudan. Atit has been speaking with displaced people and doctors in the town of El Geneina, West Darfur, where survivors of the attack have fled for safety.
I spoke with one of the youth leaders who fled violence from Mestere village to El Geneina town a few days ago. He told me he currently sheltering in one of the schools within the town, and he also mentioned that there are similar shelters that are temporarily being occupied by these IDPs, schools and other government buildings within the town. He estimated the numbers of the IDPs who actually arrived from different villages to the town in the past few days between 9,000 to 10,000 individuals.
And what did he tell you about the conditions of these people who fled the attacks?
They are lacking food, they are lacking medicines, and they are in need also of shelter, because since it is a rainy season, it has been raining also quite a few days ago. He actually appealed to the humanitarian aid agencies. Up to this moment, none of them has reached out to assess their situation or to see what are their needs and all, according to him. And he actually called on UN agencies and other international agencies to quite intervene so that to save lives of children and women and elderly who actually managed to cut a long way of 40 kilometers from the village up to El Geneina town.
You also spoke to a doctor in El Geneina. What did he tell you?
Local doctors actually at El Geneina Teaching Hospital confirmed to me that the total number of people who they received in the hospital were 54 wounded persons on Sunday. 3 of them were immediately put in the ICU, and the 15 of them who were seriously injured with a critical condition, they were airlifted on Monday to Khartoum for further treatment, according to him. He also mentioned that the hospital itself have started receiving women and children with malaria diseases, with other stomach diseases, coughing, flu, and other things from among the IDPs, newly arrived IDPs, who are actually currently sheltering at schools and other government buildings.
Now, the government said earlier this week that it will send troops to quell the violence. Any more information on how the authorities are responding?
The newly appointed civilian governors, named by the Sudanese Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok, they actually took an oath of office on Monday. The Prime Minister instructed them immediately to report to their respective states and to work with local communities to settle all cases or to restore peace among the communities. The governor of South Darfur, one of the 5 governors for Darfur region, he actually spoke to the media on behalf of other governors and said he's going to Niala. He vowed that they are going to work together with all his colleague governors so that they're able to restore peace and calm and stability to the people of Darfur.
And what about Sudan's political parties? Have they made any statements or demands about the situation?
I have not come across any statement from any political parties regarding the situation in Darfur, but I've seen on social media some activists in Khartoum here organize actually a demonstration yesterday in Omdurman, trying to send this message that Darfur is bleeding. Let the government intervene to stop the bloodshed. So all in all, there are no much reaction from the Sudanese political parties up to now. now the only group who reacted openly, these activists.
That was journalist Michael Atit in Khartoum, Sudan. The United States military has admitted to inflicting civilian casualties in an airstrike in Somalia. The U.S. originally said that the February 2nd airstrike killed a, quote, terrorist, end quote. But now the U.S. military's Africa Command, also known as AFRICOM, says that in fact the airstrike killed a young woman and injured three other civilians. Two of them were children, the other was an elderly woman. AFRICOM has launched dozens of airstrikes in Somalia as part of its efforts to support Somalia's government in Mogadishu against the Al-Shabaab rebel group, but AFRICOM has come under heavy criticism for killing and wounding civilians in its airstrikes. Earlier this year, AFRICOM announced it would make quarterly reports responding to such allegations. VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb spoke to AFRICOM spokesman Chris Carnes, who is a U.S. Air Force colonel. Here's his explanation on why the woman was killed and her relatives injured.
It was, a situation where, the individuals who were injured and the one woman who was killed, they just weren't visible when the airstrike occurred.
Carnes said AFRICOM does its best to avoid civilian casualties.
We are always looking for ways to improve and, ways to be more transparent. When there is an allegation, we do everything possible to assess it and make a determination. And if we've, found to have made a mistake, we will admit to it because, accountability and trust is key to any military operation, and we don't want to do anything to impact that. And when you consider our operations, we do everything possible to reduce the risk to civilians. Prior to any airstrike, we consider weapon effects, delivery parameters. We look at and carefully assess the target, and we look to minimize risk to civilians.
AFRICOM said there are four more incidents currently under review.
There are still some allegations that are being investigated, and we'll continue to make sure that we look into the circumstances, the facts, as appropriate. And even when a determination is made, if there's new information or facts that are presented, we continue to look at an allegation.
The human rights group Amnesty International has been investigating civilian casualties inflicted by AFRICOM's airstrikes in Somalia. Brian Kastner is a researcher for the group. He told me that AFRICOM's changing story about the February 2nd incident calls into question the U.S. military's methodology for assessing civilian casualties in Somalia.
It does make you wonder what they do for a battle damage assessment afterwards, that they decided they knew specifically how many people died and that person was a terrorist. It does call into question what methods they are using after the strike to make these assessments so quickly and so definitively.
Kastner called on AFRICOM to compensate the families of those killed and injured.
So we don't do these investigations just to prove AFRICOM wrong. We do these investigations so that way the families of the victims have justice for the loss of their loved ones. And that involves first AFRICOM admitting what that they did and that the family is right, that there's, that they were not members of Al-Shabaab, that AFRICOM should not have done the strike. And then the next step is for AFRICOM to actually speak to these families, to reach out, to talk to the surviving members and to pay reparations. And so that way the families have justice for this.
In its Tuesday statement, AFRICOM said it reviewed six other alleged incidents of U.S. airstrikes killing or injuring non-combatants, but did not find any civilian casualties. I asked Kastner if he agreed with that assessment.
We don't. I mean, out of those other incidents that they reviewed, another one was a case that we investigated, which involved a farmer and member of the Hormuz telecommunications company being killed at his banana farm north of Jilib. We believe he was a civilian. AFRICOM has said that they gave an explanation of why they believed that he was an Al-Shabaab commander.
But Kastner said AFRICOM is making positive steps toward being more transparent.
I will say at least AFRICOM is now providing a reason why they believe that their attack was legitimate. Now, we disagree with their findings, but at least we're having some agreement on some of the basic facts of the case, which, to be fair to AFRICOM, is a step, you know, over the last couple years when AFRICOM really just didn't engage in these issues at all. And so, you know, I think they are making some progress that we have to acknowledge, that they are giving detailed answers for each one of these cases, and that's to their credit.
AFRICOM's next report on civilian casualty allegations in Somalia is expected in 3 months. The Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, which is Uganda's main opposition party, is accusing President Yoweri Museveni of interfering with the works of the Electoral Commission. FDC spokesman Sumuju Nganza accused the Electoral Commission of working under direction of the president. Reporter Mugume Davis Rakarinje has more from Kampala, Uganda.
Sumuju Nganza, spokesman for Uganda's FDC opposition party, accused the country's Electoral Commission of working under the directions of President Yoweri Museveni. On Monday, Nganda told journalists that the Electoral Commission was in two courts turmoil because of interference from the president.
It is now Museveni running electoral affairs at State House. The people at the Electoral Commission are just watching.
Last week, some top officials in the Electoral Commission, including the Commission Secretary, resigned pending an investigation into accusations of flouting procurement procedures, local media reported. Nganda says the officials were wrongly dismissed.
We're not in any way suggesting that they are angels. It is possible that in evaluating bids, they may have committed irregularities. That is very possible. But the truth of the matter is that Mr. Museveni wants them out because they are attempting to outsmart him, reading to him the law.
VOA was unable to get a response from the Electoral Commission on the accusations of interference from the presidency, as the commission recently suspended its spokesman. The commission chairman, Justice Simon Byabakama, was not available for comment. However, Byabakama said in a statement last Friday that the officials were not dismissed, but had opted for an early retirement. Don Innocent Wanyama is a senior press secretary to Uganda's president. He dismisses the opposition's claims of interference from the presidency. Wanyama says the opposition should rather concentrate on seeking for votes than politicking.
What the opposition are trying to do is, as usual, to prepare Ugandans for their imminent loss in the coming election. And they are looking for all manner of excuses. They have failed to go out and tell Ugandans what they want to do. They are now sitting in Kampala and trying to find whatever excuses they can. That is total hogwash. The president doesn't control the commission. The commission does its work independently.
Ugandan activists have raised concerns as to why the officials resigned after the electoral process for 2020-2021 general elections has already started. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Also in Uganda, free speech advocates are calling for the release of a comedy group arrested last week on accusations of promoting sectarianism. Members of the group, known as Bizonto, were arrested after performing a skit that criticized government's leaders. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Artists on social media are using the hashtag #FreeMyTalent as they call on the government to free the four-person group called Bizonto. The comedians, still in police custody since their arrest Friday, have yet to be charged, but police say they are investigating the issue as a case of sectarianism. In their skit, the comedians make fun of longtime President Yoweri Museveni and other leaders. Tell the children that Yoweri Kaguta Museveni is their president and they should pray for him. He came to power in 1986. He's ruled the country for 35 years and he still rules. So they should pray for him because he is the leader. Tell the children that General Eli Tumwine is the head of security. It's a very important position. Because of that, they should pray for him. Nicholas Opio, director of Chapter 4, a human rights non-government organization, says freedom of expression exists to protect speech that makes people uncomfortable. He says to this effect, Ugandans should ridicule their leaders and in so doing discuss serious issues of governance that affect the country.
Artistic expressions are made to lampoon leaders as a way of expressing one's view. and I think it is protected speech. Instead of arresting them, I think we must ask the question of whether they raise a serious issue through their skits. And we must have an honest discussion about equity, about the sharing of the national cake in this country.
The group was arrested at a local radio station. Ofwono Pondo, a government spokesperson, blames the media, questioning why a news organization would start sectarian tendencies as the country moves into an election cycle.
The government is not going to sit by and watch people attempting to break the unity we have fought so hard to build. The harmony, social community harmony, we have fought so hard to build over the last 34 years.
The government early this year set up new proposals that seek to vet new songs, videos and film scripts prior to their release. The proposals also demand that musicians, producers, promoters, filmmakers and all other artists register with the government and obtain a license that can be revoked for a range of violations. Artists are taking to social media to urge people to speak up. They include singer Robert Kyagulanyi, who is popularly known as Bobby Wine. He is running for president as the candidate from the National Unity Platform.
I'm reminding all of us to rise up now and assert our voices and defend what is rightfully ours, because freedom of expression is a right. And remember that no creative, no artist is safe. We are all under attack.
Police say they have in their possession dozens of videos that show the detained artists promoting sectarianism. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
This month, Sierra Leone's parliament made a progressive step for freedom of speech when they unanimously voted to repeal a law that criminalized libel, journalists in the West African country say. Ahmed Saheed Nasrallah is the president of the Sierra Leone Journalist Association. He said the libel law was the only law in Sierra Leone that allowed for pretrial detention and that it was mostly used by politicians to target journalists. Nasrallah spoke from Freetown to Ricky Shryock about what the law entailed and why its repeal could mark a new dawn for the media in Sierra Leone.
The common practice has been that the police will arrest you on a Friday and then they will detain you throughout the weekend. The Sierra Leone Association of Journalists will have to intervene and appeal to the police to secure your release. Because this law criminalizes our work and there is a high possibility for jail term, women are not attracted to the profession. And those who are already in the profession shy away from taking up leadership positions in the media. Beyond that, because everybody involved in the production of the alleged libelous material or libelous publication or broadcast, the media do not attract private sector investment. So I think that the repeal will reverse all of these negatives and open the media up to many opportunities. I think journalists now have the freedom and the liberty to do their work without fear or favor. And this is not only for journalists. We must know that, because this law affects everybody, including citizens of Sierra Leone. So this is a victory for every citizen of Sierra Leone, including the politicians themselves, because people will now be free to express their opinions on national issues and then contribute to the democratic discourse without the fear of being jailed or being detained or being arrested by the police.
And what are some of the challenges that remain when we talk about freedom of speech, freedom of expression, and journalism in Sierra Leone?
To me, the biggest challenge is the economy of the media. And Sierra Leone, we know, is a third world country, and the economy is struggling. With the coming of COVID-19, the situation is even worse now. So we see in communications that the media is usually a reflection of the society in which it operates. And so we see that the media is in poverty in some way, because business is not forthcoming, advertisement is not forthcoming, and the circulation or the sales is dwindling. And there is also the challenge of politics of the media. In our country, and especially in these current times, we see journalists have become attracted to politics, and this is undermining their professionalism as well as their independence.
That was Ahmed Saheed Nasrallah, president of the Sierra Leone Journalist Association, speaking to Ricky Shryock from Freetown. That's it for this Wednesday, July 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of managing editor James Butsey, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great day.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.